Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Senate Finance. It's about 9 o'clock, and it's Wednesday, January 28th. Today, we're going to hear an overview from Sarah Fisher Goad from the Energy Authority. And, Sarah, if you could go ahead and come up. Thank you. And before we get going, I want to recognize that Senator Marchicki, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator McKinnon, Senator Hoffman are at the table, as well as myself, Senator Kelly. And we are probably ready to go unless there's some comments or questions that the committee has to bring forward before we get started. Hearing none, Sarah, you have the floor. I just also want to recognize that former Senator and former Senate President Jean Terrio is in attendance with us. Hello, Jean. Senator. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sarah Fisher Goad, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. So we've prepared an overview of AEA programs. We'd like to start with this slide just to make sure that, just to remind folks that we are an independent corporation of the state. We are organized under Commerce. Our mission is to reduce the cost of energy. One thing I just want to note on a lot of the programs and the powers and the duties that we have, although AEA is organized under 4483, a lot of the programs that we manage are really the powers and duties assigned to us that the legislature has assigned to us under AS 4245. So a lot of the state energy programs that we talk about and a lot of the responsibilities that we have received from the legislature are really through that statute. So one of the things that we've done this past year on looking at how we are organized to provide our services is really looking at a continuum of project development. We've wanted to really emphasize community assistance in working on our policy and planning development. We wanted to kind of what we thought were developing some silos from alternative energy to what was traditionally known as rural energy. We really wanted to restructure this to really look at what our functions are, and we reorganized slightly to be able to do that. And the PowerPoint actually kind of follows this outline a bit, where we talk about policy and outreach programs, our program development, which would be the Renewable Energy Fund and the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, is two of the biggest highlights of the programs. Our operations and project implementation with our rural energy infrastructure construction that we do, and then our owned infrastructure, which would be Bradley, the Intertie, and then our development of the Susitna-Wetana project. So, again, one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we emphasize is the amount of collaboration that we do with other state agencies and with non-governmental entities. We have a lot of collaborative working groups. We have the Alaska Wind Working Group, which really is, there's about 90 participants between utilities, contractors, entities that are, really in the thick of developing wind projects, in addition to governmental agencies and nonprofits that we work with. So we have a regular wind working group that meets to discuss issues in Alaska about development of wind projects in the state. We are involved and we've been funded through the last few years on regional energy planning and really to work with the regions of the state beyond the rail belt in the southeast where we've done plans to look at where what the region's priorities are in order to fund energy projects. And so there's about 11 subgroups that we are working with and over 169 participants. We've had a longstanding energy efficiency partnership. Us and AHFC and other entities meet quarterly to discuss energy efficiency efforts in the state. Again, the other groups that we work with is the Wood Energy Development Task Force and the Energy Ambassadors. And we've had a little bit more of a through the Tribal Energy Office in the U.S. Department of Energy. There's been a lot of focus through the federal government, through the Department of Energy, for working on some tribal issues and some of the rural issues that we face. So we've welcomed that enhanced collaboration with the Department of Energy on those projects. And so we have many different collaborations on interagency works, interagencies, EPA 111D, the Clean Air Plan, the Alaska Energy Authority, along with RCA and the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Law, worked quite extensively on working on the responses to EPA with respect to the challenges that AEA would have, or to the state of Alaska would have, with respect to the Clean Energy Plan. And so we also have specific stakeholder groups that we also work with. And again, we really wanted to make sure that we emphasize the collaborative approach that we're taking with the development of projects and the community assistance that that we want to provide through all of our programs. So we, you know, in order to do that and the work that we've done, we want to make sure that we assist communities to move to a project-ready status. It's not just assisting communities for the Renewable Energy Fund. It's assisting communities to make sure that they are able to take advantage of all the services that that we're able to provide and other entities. So we've worked with communities on power cost equalization issues helping them prepare for loan applications and also grant applications, whether they be federal grant applications or grants potentially to the Renewable Energy Fund. And again, our effort really has been to focus on these communities, break down these internal silos, that it's not an alternative energy project or a rural energy project. There are many rural projects that are alternative energy or renewable projects. A couple of the highlights in the Power Cost Equalization Program from this past year is we have worked very hard to make sure all the communities that are eligible for PC are able to take advantage of that program. So this past year, we helped four communities be reinstated into the PCE program. That really only leaves four non-participating communities, and we continue to work with them to make sure that they get the reports into the regulatory commission that they need to in order to be reinstated to the program. So, again, just, you know, the quick refresher on the Power Cost Equalization Program. The limitations on the program are, or the assistance is for community facilities and for residential customers. For the residential customers, it's to provide 500 kilowatt hours per month, most residents actually use less than 500 kilowatt hours per month for the program. The community facilities, we recently adopted regulations to help clarify the community facility eligibility and clarify when state and federal funds are involved with the management of a facility on whether that facility is eligible. And so through those efforts and through those regulatory changes, we've actually had a lot of interest in making sure that communities have their community facilities on the registers and are receiving a PCE assistance for that particular building. So the PCE level rates, this is what for the PCE eligible communities, the yellow shows what the utility rate is prior to the PCE. The blue shows the effective rate after PCE is applied. And what the program is really shooting for is that base rate, which is that average between Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage. And it's roughly 14.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And you can see there's still a few.
Could you pause just for a moment, Senator Machicki?
Hi, hello, Sarah. Through the chair, just a quick question: what is the base rate where above a community is eligible for PCE?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the base rate I believe is about 14.5% or 14.5 kilowatt cents per kilowatt hour. And that's that average for Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau.
Okay, thank you.
And through the chair, Senator Machicki, there are a few communities that may have costs that are below that, that although use diesel, have costs below that. I think Metlakatla is one community that has a lower rate. There's also some North Slope communities that have a local assistance that provides slightly. They are eligible for PCE and receive PCE, but it's a very small amount due to the subsidy that's provided from, I believe, the borough.
Just a quick follow-up. Who has the authority to approve a community that's under 14.5 cents?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the Regulatory Commission actually Well, some communities are not rate regulated. They are. They have a CPCN through the Regulatory Commission. However, some communities or some utilities are not necessarily rate regulated. What RCA will do for PC eligible communities that are not rate regulated, the unregulated utilities, they take a look at the eligible costs that are very similar to a tariff structure, and so they evaluate a community's cost based on similar criteria for fuel and non-fuel costs as if they were regulated.
So, Sarah, question. So you've identified Metlakatla, maybe there's some other communities, but so Metlakatla actually has a power cost that's under the average of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Why are they eligible for power cost equalization? And maybe you just explained that, but
Mr. Chairman, they're eligible based upon what they generated power in 1984. However, since if their costs are lower, they wouldn't receive any type of a PCE rate. For example, the PCE communities that you see here, none of them would be receiving a PCE rate that would push them below that base rate from Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. I think
they're just in the mix, but they're
not, got it. Yes.
All right. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah, why are we using Fairbanks when we know Fairbanks has some of the highest costs in the calculation to bring up the cost for everyone else?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the statute requires us for RCA to evaluate the floor based upon Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And just a note on that is not the entire Fairbanks North Star borough. They're actually using the city of Fairbanks. So if I don't have that information with me, but if you look at the makeup of how that's impacted, it's only about 7%. The weighted rate, it's only about 7% that Fairbanks impacts. So although those costs are higher, it's less of an impact of the floor. The floor is really primarily driven by what Chugach Electric Association that is servicing most of Anchorage to make up that floor. That's over 50% of that calculation.
And when we made the calculations, actually Fairbanks was quite affordable.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McKinnon, follow up.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering whether that needs to be re-looked at. the only reason I say that is Fairbanks has been suffering some fairly high rates of energy costs. And if Anchorage is ground zero, and the formula reflects that, that seems fair. Southeast would be, in some instances, pulling the 14.5 cent bar down because they have cheaper kilowatt hours, and Fairbanks would be pulling it up. So it's a combination of all of it. I just know we've had people from Fairbanks telling us, just like some places in rural Alaska, that their costs are upwards of 50% of their disposable income for energy, which is the same that we hear from rural Alaska at times. So
there is a as I've been told, a rate reduction coming. Pretty significant, too. Senator Bishop, do you have some insight on that?
I'm a given number, so don't quote me, but I'm going to be like the economist that's been talking to us for 2 days, but I think it's, I saw where Corey said in the paper, I think it's got a 17% reduction.
Yeah.
Senator McChicken. But I like Senator McKinnon's idea of maybe looking at it and handicapping the Fairbanks rate.
Senator McChicken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a suggestion. Could you, Sarah, could you provide the chair with the formula? Just so without taking too much time today, we can understand that and see if it needs another look.
Through the chair, Senator McChicken will be happy to provide that information. It's there's five utilities involved in that calculation. But it will be clear. As we culled down the slides to use today, the PCE levels, trying to touch on all the programs, we didn't include that one. But we have a really thorough PCE presentation. We'll make sure we give that information to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Go ahead.
So, one of our primary initiatives through policy and planning has been the regional energy planning. And, you know, the energy pathways that was produced several years ago led to the regional planning that we're undertaking now. As I had mentioned before, we have we had a rail belt organized plan and a southeast integrated regional plan. And what we've wanted to do in looking at the different regions beyond those two is to learn, especially from the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan, on making sure that we address really the unique situations of each of the regions and make sure that these plans are much more locally driven and kind of led by some regional entities, and we took more of a technical assistance and approach on providing some guidance on what these plans should look like, pulling together the stakeholder meetings and the regional planning meetings, but really making sure that it's really being driven at the regional level with a lot of involvement on on local stakeholders, on utilities, school districts, and other community leaders that are interested in the energy planning. So we're helping to provide a consistent format for these planning efforts. Again, it is very much community driven, with us to help provide some project management and a bit of oversight. We've developed these into a phased process of information gathering and the working drafts, the stakeholder engagement and the feedback process, and then where most of the plans are heading towards now is phase three, is the technical and economic analysis of the draft plan. And then also, and I'll talk a little bit more in just a few slides on our efforts through last year's legislation of SB 138, the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy. So we've had some completed plans, and here's some of the ongoing plans that we're working on throughout the state. We have an advisory role with Navista Light and Power is leading the Lower Yukon and Kuskokwim areas, but they've been very much involved with us in working with the other plans and learning what works with the regional planning and also just making sure that there's a good share of information and techniques on how to develop the plans. So the status that we have on these plans, and you can see what contractor we're working with, and again, most of the times we are dealing with an ARDR. A couple differences are that Tanana Chiefs Conference is leading the Yukon-Koyukuk Upper Tanana region. The Northwest Arctic Borough has been very much leading the Northwest Arctic plan. I mentioned before the Navista is collaborating with us, but they have been working with us through their plan. And you can see the phases that the plans are at. And most of these regional plans are moving along quite nicely, and we do anticipate this summer that these plans will be complete and moving into kind of the next phase of our planning, which was the work that we are undertaking with the Affordable Energy Strategy. And so we do see a real synergy on the regional plans that have been that we've been working on for the last couple of years, all the technical and economic analysis that we're providing and working with the regions on to really develop the report that the legislature is looking for in January of 2017 for the Affordable Energy Strategy. And this is, and we've called it that based upon really what the legislature in passing 138 and looking at what we were required to do in this effort. We really thought that the Affordable Energy Strategy made the most sense on really moving that planning effort forward. And the one thing that we've tried to emphasize with our regional plans, and also the difference between the regional plans and the Affordable Energy Strategy, is what we wanted to make sure that the regional plans and the regional leaders looked at on those is that those should be for community and regional priorities, however, not necessarily tied to whether the state of Alaska would be funding those projects. That should be an independent one where there's a multitude of funding sources or loans that would be available, possibly existing programs that would be able to fund some of the regional priorities, but not dependent upon state funds. What's a little bit different that we see on the SB 138 approach on the affordable energy strategy, that this is really looking at if the gas line goes through and there is a good deal of the state of Alaska receiving that direct benefit, for the regions of the state that would not receive a direct benefit from the pipeline, how would we then provide a benefit in an indirect way? And so that's the planning that we're doing. And so this is a little bit more of an effort to look at, if funds are made available through the AKLNG effort, how best would those funds be expended to help bring that indirect benefit to these other regions of the state. So one of the things that we've done is really to kind of categorize, you know, between electricity and heat, just a way to kind of manage how people are in these various regions, how they are receiving their electricity and heat now. And in electricity, there are some communities that have natural gas and renewables, and you can see from the dots in there that a lot of that is the Rail Belt region. So electricity has natural gas and renewables. We have Bradley Lake Hydro, and we have a lot of gas resources for electricity development in the Rail Belt. There are some areas of the state that don't have natural gas, but they have renewables for electricity, and those would be primarily Southeast Alaska, that has a lot of mature hydro to provide electricity for that region. There's a lot of small communities in rural Alaska, in the Southwest and the Northwest part of the state, that there at this point there's not natural gas, and there's very little renewables that are being used. Now, we of course are making an effort to change that in displacing diesel by developing renewable resources and wind resources, but there's still a lot of communities on a community by community basis that are still fully dependent upon a diesel generator system for their electricity. Now, there are a couple of communities in the North Slope region that do have natural gas, but really don't have any developable renewables at this point. And similar on the heat, the one thing that changes in the heat factor, Mr. Chairman, in the committee, is that, you know, there are South Central has natural gas and some renewables for heat. But of course, in Fairbanks, there's not the natural gas at this point, or very little natural gas, but a bit of renewables with some biomass efforts in the South Central. So there's a little bit of a difference in the heat in a few areas, but there's still, again, a lot of small rural communities that really have, I guess, what we call the quadrant three, that there's no natural gas at this time and no renewables. And so this is kind of a place for us to kind of start to kind of section the state off in a way to be able to kind of manage what we're really trying to do here. And what we really want to do is look at these cost-effective strategies to provide affordable energy. And oftentimes, if you're what you really want to do is move from that no gas and no renewable to a potentially a renewable situation, and perhaps there's a wind project that can move a community into a renewable resource place to deliver their electricity or heat.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, are we 100% certain on these no gas, no renewables, or do you think there could be some information coming down the road that there could be a discovery or renewable?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, our goal there was really to kind of try and categorize what people are using now, not necessarily saying that there's no renewables, but it's really an effort to, in a current situation, there may be no gas, there may be no renewables, but we want to move them to an opportunity to use renewables that are there, or potentially develop gas where there hasn't been gas used before. And so it's not we're not trying to box people into a particular quadrant. We're just trying to categorize where we think folks are right now, and what can we do to kind of change that paradigm to move folks into having more opportunities and more diversification of the energy resources.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
So some of the strategies that we have developed, and this is a little bit of a busy chart, but what we've wanted to do is really kind of emphasize, you know, energy efficiency in the heart of it can be used in any region. We think that it's very important to make sure that we continue to emphasize that, you know, energy is an important strategy for both electricity and in particular for heat. Heat recovery, improved operations and maintenance of systems, you know, potential transportation improvements are all things that can be taken advantage of in communities regardless of what their resource mix is right now. And, of course, there are some communities that through diesel efficiency and for bulk fuel storage can also be improved upon to improve the cost of their energy. So we just really want to, you know, make sure folks see what we see as strategies and just kind of give you an idea of kind of what we're laying down as a foundation of how we're trying to make this affordable energy strategy, looking at here are the things that the state of Alaska can be in a position to potentially do to make a difference and actually provide affordable energy to more regions of the state. So, and Mr. Chairman, it's, you know, this was a project that we started this summer, and we do want to continue to have this dialogue with community leaders, our regional planners, and the legislature to make sure that the way we're seeing the affordable energy strategy come together, we want to make sure that we can fulfill what the legislature is looking for a report in 2017. I think sometimes one of the things that I've observed with respect to planning at times is you can have 10 people in a room and you have 10 different ideas of what a report is going to look like. And, you know, our goal is through these next couple of years with developing this report back to the legislature that, you know, we want to make sure that there are no unintended consequences and that folks support what is coming out of the report. There may not be at least know what it's going to say and not be surprised that it doesn't say what you're expecting. Because we've been through that. I think one of the learning experiences with Southeast Integrated Resource Plan is I think there are some folks that thought there would be more of a, here's a list of 50 projects and here's the order in which they should be built. And that's not what that plan had done. I think that plan through the years has actually come to life very much, and the recommendations on developing biomass has been something that we've been seeing a lot of effort in Southeast Alaska to do. But when that plan was first developed, it wasn't something that was heartily embraced by the region. And so we want to make sure that where we've learned those lessons through the development of certain plans, that we make sure that we get to a point where folks do understand what this affordable energy strategy is hopefully going to say, and that hopefully the legislature will find it useful. So moving on to some of our program developments, the Renewable Energy Grant Fund is a program set up for, it's a recommendation program, and we go through an evaluation process of applications every year of renewable resources to essentially give a list to the legislature every year of projects that we recommend for funding. That actually is due this year on January 30th. This afternoon we actually have a meeting with our Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee to discuss some of the to discuss our recommendation process and our projects for the round 8 applications. And I'll talk a little bit more about where we've got some in just a second on the round 8 issues. But I think the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, it's important to, you know, recognize some of the metrics that we continue to see in this program, that there's a very significant benefit-cost ratio of the projects that we see that are in operation. I think the program is doing what the legislature had intended it to do, where we are capitalizing on the local energy resources. We are displacing diesel and natural gas equivalents to the tune of 13 million gallons in 2013. We've actually have a national recognition from the Clean Energy States Alliance, of which AEA is a member. AEA and Kodiak Electric Association received an award for Kodiak being a 98% renewable community. So it was actually nice to receive that recognition on the work that Kodiak Electric Association has done much through the program.
Senator Hoffman and then Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that displacing diesel is a good thing, but the overall mission is to reduce energy costs in rural Alaska. And many, particularly in Western Alaska, the district that I represent, much of the displaced diesel is going toward wind power, and that wind power is used for electricity. And because we have the PC program, what it's doing is reducing the state's liability on PCE. For the most part, it's not all the way across the board, but the result isn't that much of a decrease in the cost of energy. So I understand the importance of keeping track of the gallons of diesel that rural Alaska is so dependent upon, but that should not be the driving goal. The goal needs to be, when we institute programs, that we are reducing the cost of energy to the people of Alaska.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Machicki?
Well, I had another question, but just to play off of Senator Hoffman there, can PCE be used when you move from diesel to a renewable, such as wind? How pure is the program? Can the PCE be used to reduce the cost of that project so that the rates actually do come down for citizens in that region?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the interaction between the Power Cost Equalization Program and the Renewable Energy Fund, we have some information on another presentation that I'll provide to the committee that provides a little bit more of a showing that relationship between PCE and the Renewable Energy Fund. But one thing to keep in mind, one of the bigger metrics is the Power Cost Equalization Program for the communities that are eligible for PCE. Approximately one-third of the kilowatt hours in those communities are eligible for PCE. So when you put a renewable energy source into a community, it's impacting 100% of the kilowatt hours that are generated in the community. So 60% of the kilowatt hours are actually receiving that direct benefit of the diesel displacement and seeing that cost reduce. It's that third of the It's the third of the kilowatt hours that are being that are impacted by PCE that really the savings benefited from the Renewable Energy Fund. The state of Alaska actually shares in that through reduction of the PCE program draw. And that's where I think Senator Hoffman's concern has been, is that if you're in a PCE community and you have an effective rate at, for example, 20 cents a kilowatt hour, you may have a pre-PCE level at 40 cents a kilowatt hour, but since you're already at 20 cents with the PCE level, if your pre-PCE level goes down because of the renewable, your PCE subsidy is going to change, and you're not going to a resident isn't going to see that direct benefit. So the strength of the renewable program is the two-thirds of the kilowatt hours that aren't covered under the PCE program. Schools, for example, aren't covered under the PCE program. So if you have a renewable project in a community, a school would receive that direct benefit by cost going down and that diesel being displaced. So there is a little bit of a trade-off. And part of it is the kind of the suite of programs that impact a community. And so there is a little bit of an overlap. And I will provide a little bit more information to the committee on how that interaction, because we have some graphics that actually show that pretty nicely.
Senator Machicki?
Two follow-ups. One's a different subject. But so And I'm interested in this. I'm trying to avoid being kindly scolded by Senator Hoffman like I was yesterday again. But
kindly scolded.
So theoretically, a community could enjoy the benefits of a renewable energy project and their energy costs could go up to the individual?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I think the issue is that they may not go down. I don't.
Okay.
I think that's really the issue, because PCE is already bringing that cost down.
We'll spend a little more time on that.
I'd be happy to do that.
Another question?
I did. So, the goal, I understand your goal, but where has renewable energy displaced natural gas in a way that would reduce generation or heat space or space heating costs?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I think the project that it has the most impact is that there is a solid waste project through MLMP that is displacing natural gas. And I'll provide the committee some more information about that project.
Okay.
Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to put on the record that I serve on Alaska's the advisory board for the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. Senator Hoffman and I are there, so I just wanted the committee to know that we may have other information that you might not have on that.
So noted. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a really quick funding source of rounds 1 through 7 on the applications that we received and funded. The recommendations that we've had for funding and how much money that has been dispersed through this community or through this program. And so we've had almost $250 million appropriated to the program. That's actually leveraged over $150 million of match funds. Now, in rounds 1 through 7, you can see the distribution of the projects between, and you can see where the resources are. In Southwest Alaska, there's a wind resource and projects that are being developed, hydro projects in South Central and Southeast Alaska, and, of course, biomass. So you can see the distribution, the bit of the natural distribution on the resources that are available, and communities and utilities are taking advantage of the program and putting in good applications to the program based upon the resources that are available. So one of the things that I just wanted to touch on, and one of the things that the REFAC committee will be looking at this afternoon, is there is a statutory requirement for this program. There's three primary statutory requirements. One is that the most weight is focused on the high cost areas of the state. We also are required to have a regional spread throughout the state, and then also significant weight for match provided to a project. Now, one of the things that's happened through the years is, as you can see, Southeast Alaska has done quite nicely with respect to the program. And some of that is that they are able to take advantage of it's a renewable program, and Southeast is rich in biomass and hydro. So there's a lot of projects that are just kind of a very good natural fit at times with respect to this program. So one of the things that when the advisory committee met early in January, asked us to go back and take a look at the project list, and again, you'll be receiving this list on the 30th, on Friday, to take a look at the regional spreading, look at the cost of power or the cost of energy or burden rate in the communities, and also, since the governor's budget has currently $15 million in there, take a look at capping projects at a different level than what we have had traditionally before, where we've been in high-cost areas, we'll allow a project up to $8 million, in low-cost areas up to $4 million. But with only $15 million, it would be difficult to do the regional spreading with those levels of dollars. So this afternoon, the REFAC committee will be looking at the list, taking into account those three issues on Southeast, making sure that their piece of the program doesn't grow beyond this 22%, so we can maintain some of the regional spreading. Looking at a total energy burden rate and also capping the projects. So, again, the committee will be looking at that this afternoon. And one of the things that based upon the energy burden rate, and one of the reasons that we put this slide into this presentation is to give folks an idea of really where, you know, heating degree days are. And you can certainly see this is no surprise to anybody that lives in interior Alaska and in the North Slope area, the heating degree days that, you know, you have some significant differences in the state of Alaska. And I think yesterday was a great example. I think it was probably started out at 25 or 30 below in Fairbanks, Alaska yesterday. I come down to southeast Alaska and I barely need a coat. And so there's, you know, it's a very significant difference in the heating degree days and the situations that are faced throughout the state. And so there is a very significant difference throughout the state. And of course, you know, the cold temperatures, you know, obviously increases your energy use for heating. And so we've used heating degree days and some other metrics to really, you know, evaluate that a little bit differently on the costs, the comprehensive cost of energy throughout the state, and helping that, you know, kind of adjust the recommendation list a little bit from what we had looked at in the beginning of January. So,
Sarah, I know what the concept of a heating degree day is. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me exactly what that formula is, though?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to get back to you on what the exact formula is on that.
Just a point of curiosity, that's fine.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think in its simplest form, Mr. Chairman, it may be really expensive in, like, you may have a per unit cost, extremely high per unit cost in an area, but if you only have to heat your home 2 days of the year, it's not, your cost isn't that much compared to what you really face in Fairbanks and some of the other parts of the colder parts of the state. And I think one of the things that in looking at the heating degree days, that if you can see that in the southeast areas where it's less than 9,000 heating degree days. If I recall, even in northwest parts of the United States, it's roughly half of that. So, you know, you're less than 5,000. So, in general, you can see even the state of Alaska is very different, even with southeast Alaska, to other parts of the United States. And that's something that we have to remind when I'm outside representing Alaska Energy Authority. Those are things that we always have to talk about, is that Alaska is different. And, you know, although there's this disparity in the state of Alaska, we're still a lot higher and more expensive than the rest of the United States.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah, are you getting any pushback from the federal government, the EPA, on any of the fuel sources that you've got outlined in this this packet? Biomass, for example? Can you explain to me, through the chair, again, what areas you may be getting pushback from, but also what areas are you really being encouraged to use or to pursue?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the EPA 111D has been targeted to, you know, the rail belt regions of the state, and I think where the biggest issue at play there is, you know, we're coal is used for electricity, and so there is a, you know, a significant the EPA 111D is really targeted to reduce emissions, and those emissions are the highest emissions would be your coal plants. So that it does impact, for example, the interior and Golden Valley that would use coal. And those are part of the reason that the state's comments back with respect to EPA 111D was to point out, you know, those issues. It's a local resource that we're using that's important to the state of Alaska. So I guess in general there may be, I guess, you know, pushback obviously on a national level for coal. I'm not sure that we're seeing necessarily it depends on your project by project development on, I guess, where there would be perhaps pushback. I mean, one of the issues that we have in Alaska that's unique is, you know, we're developing wind in many areas. The most developed renewable resource in the lower 48 is solar, and we just don't have those types of, we don't have the same situation in the lower 48 to really have a significant solar development in this state. So, you know, so where there's, you know, advancements and significant advancements in solar, we're just not going to see that as much. You know, through some large, you know, the experience with the Susitna-Watonna project, you know, that there's been a lot of interaction with the federal resource agencies and the concerns with respect to, you know, looking at a larger hydro project in the state of Alaska. So I guess, again, it kind of depends on the project by project basis. So so I'm not sure that it's that I can really say that there's like a concerted effort and a pushback, but there are certain different regulatory hurdles that you have depending on what the issue is. But, you know, in general, I think you know, some of the wind and some of the biomass efforts, we have a good working relationship with the Forest Service to help develop small biomass projects through our wind working group. So we have a good relationship on that, but there are certain regulatory hurdles that you have with any project development.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So would it be safe to say that your efforts are to pursue least expensive energy costs for Alaskans, especially rural Alaska? Senator Hoffman brought up the idea of getting to a point where a wind farm may not necessarily generate less expensive energy. Would it be safe to say that if we did not have pushback from the federal government on the issue of coal, that we may be utilizing more coal throughout the state of Alaska, given the fact that it's a fuel that can be stored outside, that parts of rural Alaska have abundant amount of coal? Would it be safe to say that would be a fuel that would be more utilized if it weren't for some issues with the federal government?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think for rural Alaska, because the electric generation in particular is diesel driven in a lot of small rural communities, I'm not sure that you could say that coal would be utilized any more in those communities, because diesel has been used very effectively in those communities. So I don't know if you would see a lot more coal going into the region. And actually, we've been looking at some combined heat and power, or some heating loops, with respect to whether coal could actually be a source. One of the issues that you have in rural Alaska in a small community, and you always have it's distance and load. And so whether it be coal or whether it be diesel fuel, you still have to ship a commodity into some of these small rural communities. And so that's always going to be an issue. So I think there's more economic factors with respect to the development of some of that, rather than federal government regulations, perhaps, on that. However, you know, there are still air quality rules in rural Alaska that, you know, that DEC and the, you know, the state of Alaska has to also follow. So, but I think it's a combination. There's some economic issues that also drive what the fuel usage is in rural Alaska.
Does that hold true for the rail belt? From your perspective, would we be using more coal in the rail belt if there were not federal considerations?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I'd probably want to talk to, you know, Golden Valley Electric Association with respect to that, and whether, you know, where they see some of the hurdles. You know, I think they're looking at conversion of their diesel system to natural gas, if it's available for cost. I don't know if they would be looking at additional coal. I mean, they're also developing the Healy 2 project. So they are looking at additional coal, but if there's additional hurdles, I don't know. I think that would be something that we can certainly check with Golden Valley and get back to the committee.
In just a second, Senator McKinnon, but on that point, Senator Dunleavy, I think you could actually show, just in Fairbanks, you could show where the federal interference produces the burning of more coal and where it restricts burning coal. For instance, the the University Power Plant that we funded last year, it's at 17 to 19 megawatts. It's at that point because they didn't want to have to go over the 25 megawatts to because then they would have to have a federal permit that they would face that they wouldn't get. Point is, they could have built the power plant larger and they could have served the area around it. But we can't do that because of permitting. On the other hand, we end up burning a lot more coal because there's something like 12 coal power plants in Fairbanks when really, you know, you can light up Connecticut with a couple of them. You know, we could have one coal power plant serving the entire interior if we didn't have these goofy rules. But they won't let us build that. So we end up building, burning more coal, which doesn't make sense.
To the chair, just briefly, just to follow up to that, I guess the point of my question was, we're talking about trying to drive down the cost of energy. Mm-hmm. We've seen the bottom fall out of oil now, and some folks may be saying we have some temporary relief. We don't know how long that's going to last, but there's no doubt that coal is one of the cheapest sources of energy that there is. Alaska has an abundant amount of coal. And I was just trying to ascertain where coal is in the mix of AEA's, what AEA's position is on coal. We know what the position of the federal government is on coal. And we also know what the federal government's position is on Alaska in general.
Right.
I'm just trying to find out if, are we doing any pushing in the coal area for our energy needs, or have we just basically said it's a hurdle that we're not going to climb? I know there's a, I want to say, I hate to say this, but it's almost like a vestige in Fairbanks of using coal at the university and using coal at GVA. But is coal as a possibility in this state? Is it dead, except for those one or two areas? Well, that's what I was just trying to ask. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, you know, we have in the audience Gwen Holman. Are you still here, Gwen? I'm not going to call you up or anything like that, but she is director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and they do a lot of work on coal. Interestingly enough, too, which is most people don't realize, is that the coal power plant that will be built at the university actually has lower particulate production than gas would. Go figure. Senator McKinnon, after all that, do you still remember what your question was?
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't a question. It was a follow-up on the federal influence on coal, specifically at some of our bases in Eielson and elsewhere north in the Fairbanks region. We did a tour of their plant facility some time ago, and they were alluding to the federal government regulations requiring additives to the coal products that we were burning in an effort to reduce particulate matter, which really wasn't happening, but the cost to actually put the additional components on the coal were actually costing it out, and that's what was raising the price of coal usage on those facilities. So it is the federal government that's asking us to provide additives, and to what benefit, because we are very interested in the health of our people and the particulate matter, but we're not seeing a lot of trade-off in the environment health as to the restrictions that we're receiving on coal in Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dunleavy, I think, you know, through our regional planning and the work that we're doing, you know, if there's a desire and an effort to make sure that coal is used as a resource, we want to work with the regions to see their local priorities come through. And so we have subject matter experts that are very interested in the development of coal for you know, small communities through heating loops. And such, and you know, there are federal restrictions. There are some limitations on that, but we certainly want to work with as you know many communities we want to use the local resources that we've got. And I think that's one of the issues that we had when you know developing response to the EPA 111D issue is it is a local resource that we're using. We're not importing coal from another state to use it. We're trying to use a local resource for local needs. The Renewable Energy Fund Round 8, the draft recommended projects based upon some adjustments that we've made, you can see still, even with some adjustments that we'll be looking at this afternoon, that there's still a regional mix and a statewide mix of projects that are that AEA staff is recommending for funding for the program. And again, we're at a little bit of an awkward stage on, this is the 28th of January, and our list to the legislature is due on January 30th, so we'll have a lot of historical information provided to the legislature by Friday, and then also our recommendations for Round 8. I guess moving on to the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, this program has had funding for two rounds. Last year we received an extension on the program to continue the program through 2020. Last year we didn't receive an appropriation to do another solicitation. However, this year in the most recent version of the governor's budget, there is $1 million that has been allocated in the governor's proposed budget to allow us to solicit a third round of applications. Our first round was the most significant, of almost $9 million. That was a joint effort with the Denali Commission. So it was part federal, part state funds. The second solicitation that we did was $2 million of just state dollars. We still partner with the Denali Commission. They have funded us to do some data collection. We are in partnership with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power to work with the data collection on the projects. And so this is a program that really kind of fills a void in kind of our continuum of programs and projects. That is that area where we want to make sure that we continue to find ways to advance the technology. It's all really about reducing the cost of energy, but we want to make sure that we have a method, and I think the reason that the legislature moved forward with this program is to make sure that we have an ability to really seek out those projects that can be commercially viable within 5 years. So we're looking at demonstration projects on that program. A couple project highlights in Kodiak. There are a couple mechanics that have received funding through the program to look at efficient generators in diesel electric propulsion. And we wanted to highlight this program. Part of it is that it's kind of cool to see a 97 Eagle being modified to do this test. But the program isn't. I think there's some confusion sometimes with EETF that it's not just about renewable. We're looking at diesel systems. We're looking at efficiency. So this is not a program that's just limited to renewable technology. One of the things with the EETF program, it's one of the programs that seems to spotlight the state on energy development quite frequently. We get a lot of requests, and this is just a handful of some of the national publications that have inquired about the program. I was at a Clean Energy States Alliance meeting this fall, and the state of Maryland actually has a program that's very similar to ours, and it was really nice to be able to kind of trade information about their development of their program and what we've seen in the development of ours. And so I think there's actually, it was an opportunity for us to kind of really highlight what we've learned from our program, what we think we're going to, really get out of the program, what it's doing for the state of Alaska, and we think that there is some national applications to this. And I think other states that are looking at this can see Alaska as a bit of a model program. So energy efficiency and conservation, this is an effort that is in state policy, energy policy, to reduce the per capita use by 15% by 2020. We focus on commercial buildings, rural public buildings, and some industrial facilities, and of course electrical efficiency and diesel systems. We coordinate with the state agencies. I mentioned before too the AK Energy Efficiency, the collaboration that we have with NGOs and other agencies. We actually essentially staff that quarterly effort, and we also maintain the webpage, the akefficiency.org webpage. We've had very good, strong results with our energy efficiency efforts on reducing costs and displacing diesel. We focus most of our effort on small rural communities, and you know, looking at the Village Energy Efficiency Program, the VEEP program. And so this program does target high energy cost communities, small communities, looking at their public buildings and facilities. The eligible applicants are listed there. We had seven projects that received funding of almost $1.4 million, and the projects were funded to retrofit lights and replace outdated HVAC equipment. And again, this has been a very successful program, and again, the governor's budget this year with information that was released on the 22nd of January does have money allocated to our it's listed as alternative energy and energy efficiency program, and our intention would be to use most of those funds to fund a another VEEP solicitation. So one of the things that we have done recently, and part of this is looking at how we want to make energy efficiency a cornerstone of the Alaska Energy, affordable energy strategy. 5 years ago, we, along with other state entities and regional organizations, went to NightMute to do a collaborative multi-agency effort to do what was called a whole village retrofit. And we thought it was really important that we take a look at NightMute, see what we learned, see what we could do better, and see how the retrofits that were done 5 years ago, how they were holding up. And so just this fall, a team went out to visit the community. There have been significant savings in the community. There are certain the calculations. One of the things that was a little bit of a struggle or a difficulty for the team is that the baseline information, there wasn't a lot of good baseline information prior to the retrofits. Based upon some modeling that's been done and looking at how the upgrades have upheld, you can see some of the annual energy savings is actually looking pretty good. I think a couple of things that we have a draft report that we're still working on and kind of the revisit of the NightMute situation. This was a real strong community-led effort. One of the things that I think the team discovered is waiting 5 years to go and visit a community is maybe a little bit too long of time. Probably should have been out there 1 or 2 years afterwards to see how the retrofits were being maintained and making sure that folks had the training and some education to make sure that the maintenance of the retrofits to make sure that everything was maintained appropriately. I think overall, I think the results were very good. One bit of a surprise on this is I think we had an assumption that having a bunch of entities, state and other NGOs and other entities, go all at once to a community has a significant cost savings and economies of scale to do something like that. Well, there is some of that. However, there is also a little bit of a trade-off that you can have a lot of good, significant energy efficiency development. You don't necessarily need to have a grand, full kind of all the agencies sweep in at one time to do that. And in fact, in some respects, it can be a bit overwhelming to one community trying to, you know, with limited resources. And if you want community involvement in the retrofits, in many respects, you kind of spread the community a little too thin. So that's something that we'll be taking a look at as we look at further whole village retrofits to make sure that we're sensitive to that and making sure that we have some very good, strong scheduling and timing coordination for the retrofits.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. $75,000 may not seem like a lot of money over 10 years. $750,000, it's a larger sum. But can you give us, the committee, some idea of the size of the community so that it is a very, very small community?
It is. Through the chair, I think Senator Hoffman, I believe Knight Mute is 300 people. Sorry. Thank you. I had to call in a favor. It's a little under 200 people in that community.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pretty impressive. Senator McKinnon?
Yes. Could you tell the committee how many communities are close to that community that are not connected by road? Isn't Tuxuk Bay very close in there, and there's another community there separated by about a mile?
Tunena.
Through the chair, I'd have to. I apologize. I don't know the geography and the communities that are real close to that area. But our goal is when we do village retrofits, that we do coordinate when communities are close to make sure that we provide services in a coordinated fashion. We do that a lot actually with our powerhouse. And circuit rider program, where we make sure that we're not bouncing, you know, back and forth. That we do a systematic review of the different communities, and where we may have an emergency response in one area, we can also take care of a couple circuit rider visits and provide some on-site training in the same area.
Senator McKinnon,
Mr. Chairman, the only highlight is I'm very appreciative of. Nyamute and how they've gotten together to do things, but a connection of a one-mile road would have provided benefit to two other villages, and we have three airports out there existing for those three different villages, as well as schools in each location, and it's very expensive when they're in such close proximity for a little bit larger umbrella not to be looked at. We're 250 or people are benefiting, but if we could have spread that reach just a little bit farther with some transmission lines or something, we could have benefited those other communities too. But anyway, that's
Senator Bishop.
Next slide.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, that is something with respect to transmission systems, part of the regional planning, and I know the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative has been looking at regional transmission lines to make sure that there are those economies of scale to be able to connect some of the small communities, have a larger powerhouse in one community, and have the transmission lines to help provide power to another community. So, Mr. Chairman, the energy infrastructure that we do in a lot that we are involved in rural Alaska are bulk fuel and powerhouse system upgrades. And you know, historically, we've actually been in been doing this since 2000 in partnership with the Denali Commission. Now, Denali Commission funds have tapered off significantly the past few years, but the state of Alaska has continued to fund AEA to build powerhouses and tank farms. We have completed a significant amount of infrastructure in rural Alaska. We have annually a list of projects that we are essentially seeking construction funds to make sure that we continue to do this. This is really the foundation of a lot of rural Alaska communities, that even with the integration of renewable resources in a community, you do need a strong powerhouse and a stable electrical system in order to integrate renewables into a system. So we have a circuit rider program to provide training and outreach. We've done 28 visits this past year. And in addition to actually on-the-ground circuit rider visits, we've done several, over 3,000 phone assistants with the local powerhouse operators. And so far this year, we've had, or in calendar 2014, we've had four emergencies that we've responded to. And so we, continue to look at our training models to make sure that our partnership with Avtec meets the needs of the local communities and the local powerhouse operators to make sure that they're getting the training that they need, and we're trying to make sure that we work closely with the local leaders to make sure that there are enough folks in the community that can provide that role and be to be operators in the powerhouses, the powerhouses in particular.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Sarah. Now, if you could, before you leave town or by Friday, if you come back to my office and we can have a little deeper discussion, but I'm really glad to hear that that you're working with Avtec, because they have the best integrated system that matches what you're doing out here in the bush. And these programs, these systems, they're great, but they're only as good as the people that's trained to keep them up and running and in pristine condition. Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
So, one of the things that we wanted to illustrate this year is, you know, because RPSU projects and bulk fuel projects have been funded with grant funds, especially with the Denali Commission since 2000. As we start looking at what value those projects provide to a community, I wanted to have some type of illustration on what if a powerhouse in a small community had to be debt financed, what it would do to rates, what it would do to a community. And so, you know, although this is a weighted average rate, you know, on average, if these projects were debt financed, and understand that these are some small loads in rural communities, you know, on average, though, there would be an increase of cost to a community of 19 cents per kilowatt hour on top of the rate that they are currently paying if powerhouses were funded in another in a debt service fashion. So we just wanted to show that and illustrate that these are, you know, assumption of a 5% interest rate in a 20-year life of a project. This is what it would mean to an individual ratepayer in a community. So, Mr. Chairman, just real quickly, I wanted to touch on, you know, Susitna-Watonna. There's only a couple slides that I have here, where just to, you know, let the committee know that, you know, we had a safe and effective field work this season. We had still had about 200 people out in the field, but in smaller durations to continue with the data collection. Of the 58 studies that we are working on, we have the completion of data collection for 13 of those. So we're continuing, you know, through the funding that we've received to date, we've continued to advance the project in addition to supporting the work that we need to file a license application. There's a lot of work that's being done. It's been done for us on behalf, our Fish and Game has done a lot of the work on behalf of AEA to advance this, and a lot of the work that that has been done and the information that's been gathered can be very useful to Fish and Game and other agencies to manage the resources. So we did file the initial study report with FERC. We have a statutory required annual report to the legislature that was distributed on January 20th. We just distributed that in electronic format to the legislature. One thing that we have seen with the data collection is that a lot of the work that we're doing now is showing a very consistent and similar findings that we saw in the 80s with respect to fish distribution, the bird migration, and the river system is shown to be quite stable through the years from the work that was done in the 80s, from some pictures and some information we had in the 50s, and then what we've done within the past couple of years.
Senator Bishop.
Before we move off that slide, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, how would you characterize your working relationship with the Native corporations on this project?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it's actually been quite good. We finalized, prior to the session ending last year, we finalized our land permit in order to receive access to the land to do the studies. Our team meets with the village corporations very regularly to discuss the status of the project. So I think you know that I would characterize our relationship as very, very good with the landowners in the area.
That's follow-up quick. That's what I read in the report, and I just thought it might have been a good bullet to put there on your slide.
Thank you.
By the way, for the record, I think I had said that there were 12 plants in Fairbanks. I meant the interior, and it isn't 12. It's a lower number than that, but it's a lot of power plants. I just was writing them out. I had seen 11 once, I think. Somebody said there were more. You get the two at Healy, you get UA, you've got downtown, Wainwright, Eielson, Clear, Greeley. Yeah, probably eight. Yeah. Is that right, Gene? Does that sound about right? Eight coal plants in the interior?
Greeley doesn't have a coal plant.
Oh, okay. Okay. Just wanted to clarify that. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we one of the things that we continue to update every year is the tag Chinook salmon in relation to Devil's Canyon and some of the observations that we've made with respect to you know the salmon the spawning habitats that it's not necessarily in the main stem of the river. The salmon spawn in the tributaries and off-channel habitats. Chinook are the only documented fish above Devil's Canyon, and most of the tagged Chinook are spawning in the tributaries. We just, you know, I'm one of the things that we wanted to do, and we did at least an hour-long presentation in the for the AEA Board of Directors with respect to this Susitna project, and I'm trying to cover this in just a couple slides. I think, you know, one thing that you know, we wanted to make sure that the committee understands and that the legislature, you know, understands is the funding that we received to date. The significant portion of the funding is, of course, gone to the environmental effort in order to put together a good license application. And so this is just a snapshot of some of the work that we've done and the observations from the project staff with respect to the project. So on engineering and cost of the project, we are finishing up the environmental or the engineering feasibility report that should be published, I think, by the end of this month, which, of course, is this week. The Board of Consultants has endorsed the roller compacted concrete for a dam configuration. There have been no active faults found at the proposed dam site. That was one of our field efforts this year was actually doing some drilling on at the dam site. We've confirmed that, you know, the mean annual energy as we had assumed in 2011 is showing that we can produce 2,800 gigawatt hours of power for the project. The probable cost is that you can see the range of 5 to 6.2 billion with the most probable cost being at $5.65 billion. So, you know, I guess, you know, understanding that, you know, there's a significant difference in the financing situation of the state in order to kind of move us towards license. What we did want to at least, you know, show is with based upon the work that we've done to date that we are still seeing the same. We're seeing a confirmation of what we had assumed a couple years ago when the legislature passed legislation authorizing AEA to move forward with the project. You know, we're still seeing that this project can produce what we thought were the benefits that we were seeing in 2011 and roughly, you know, 7 cents per kilowatt hour through a 50-year average wholesale power cost.
Senator Chickie and then Senator Bishop.
Sarah, through the chair, what's the seasonal fluctuation? I see your 2,800 annual mean, but what's the low?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I'll have to get back to you on that, on the seasonal fluctuation of what we think that would be modeled on the operational costs.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Senator Kelly, I don't know if you can answer this now, and if you can't, maybe if you could get me a range, what would be the price at the meter? No, and you don't have to answer that if you can't, but if you could think about that and get it back to us.
And through the chair, Senator Bishop, the price would depend if assuming that this would follow roughly a Bradley Lake model, the wholesale cost would be 7 cents a kilowatt hour, but that would change then depending on what the mix is for the utilities that would be involved. So what may be a cost in Fairbanks would be a different cost in Anchorage. So that question has been asked before, and that's something that we'd have difficulty answering, and I'm not even certain that a utility would be able to give an estimate at this point on that.
Just to follow up, that'd be a big deal for me. And I think maybe others around the table, is kind of like no different than we're talking about truck gas to Fairbanks right now, you know.
Go ahead, sir.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we'll try and work with the utilities to see if we can put some type of an idea of what that would be from wholesale to power, to retail. So, Mr. Chairman, this is a little hard to see up on the screen, but just wanted to give at least an update of where we're at with the budget since we're in a transition phase. Our operating budget is still the work in progress budget that was released on December 15th. One thing I'll note, in some of the programs that I discussed this morning are really embedded in our capital budget, and as you can see from what was released on January 22nd, we have a bulk fuel tank farm and a couple powerhouses that are slated for some funding in the governor's budget, money for the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, our electrical emergencies response, and also the alternative energy and energy efficiency, the $2.2 million that is slated there. We anticipate $2 million would be used directly for a VEEP program, all going to grants to small communities, eligible communities for that program, and a small portion of those funds would be used to provide state match for the state energy projects or the state energy program, some USDA, U.S. Department of Energy funds that we receive, and then also some grant funds that require match. For example, our biomass program has a couple grants needing match. And that actually concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dunleavy?
Through the chair, I've got a couple questions that are pretty crucial for myself, given that this particular project lies entirely within my district, including the downstream Susitna River.
Just go ahead, get into a dialogue with her. You don't need
just real quick, before I get to that, we have also within our district, my district, we have a number of different areas that would be considered stranded areas of energy. In other words, we don't have the inner ties to shift energy and sell energy and share energy. And maybe I missed it, but are there going to be attempts this year? I know I've talked with some folks in the energy community here in the Senate. I'm looking at the concept of interties to take care of the stranded energy so it can be shared with other places in the rail belt that may reduce costs for everybody involved. Are there discussions on closing those gaps?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, AEA has commissioned a backbone energy study with respect to how to strengthen the transmission system throughout the rail belt. I know the rail belt utilities are working together to look at some type of a unified system operator system that could work to help facilitate trying to receive those savings on being able to have a robust system to be able to do economic dispatch through the rail belt. So we've commissioned the report and are, you know, working with the utilities and communicating with them, you know, with respect to that. And I think we're trying to support their efforts where we can. And Gene Terrio is here. He's the deputy director that's worked with this with the utilities the most on this concept. So if there it may be appropriate for Gene to answer some questions more specifically on that. So
so it's just that regardless of whether Montana moves forward, the concept of whether it does or does not, the concept of interties and connecting all of these groups, I think is something that really needs to be looked at as as a cornerstone in this energy concept. And I just have a couple more requests, and I'll request it through the chair, but I want to put it on the record. Sarah, could you provide us with the PFM financial report? I see your folks nodding their heads back there. Could you provide us with the MWH global cost report? I don't see any heads nodding. Heads nodding. The cost report, the AECOM cost report, would be another report that I think would be valuable for myself and this committee to really understand the different some of the details. And then there's a independent feasibility report that was referenced by your project manager Wayne in a December meeting when he was speaking with a reporter from Talkeet, and there was some type of financial independent feasibility report that if we can get that I think also would be very helpful. And then I'm going to wrap it up here, but the National Marine Fisheries was critical of AEA's fish study, and I'm just wondering if AEA has responded to that report, to that letter, and if so, would that response be able to be shared as well with the committee? And if there's any other studies on fish impacts on the downstream side of the dam going all the way down to the mouth of Susitna, if those reports could also be shared with the committee. And then would there be any reason why those reports could not be posted online on your website for the public to also take a look at?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the reports, I think a couple of things that you had referenced, we have provided and made available to folks. I think I'll need to get some specifics on what you're looking at. Since we are kind of in this, we've asked for and have been granted with FERC a 60-day, you know, essentially a suspension with respect to where we're at with the project. So some of the, we also canceled some meetings early in January after receiving the administrative order to kind of, you know, let's take a step back, get the information that we need to provide to the governor in response to the administrative order. So some of the things haven't been necessarily, you know, completed and filed with FERC. I think some of the things that you mentioned, though, have been completed, and we can certainly provide copies to you on what is available. With respect to the NIMS letter, I believe we did file a letter in response. I know prior to us having our initial study report meetings, we responded to NIMS and filed that letter with FERC. So we can certainly, that's on the FERC page, but we can certainly make sure you get a copy of that.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anything to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.